The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
Welcome to the College Football Podcast. David Pollock and Kevin Negandhi with you here on this episode. We'll hear from David later on as Georgia head coach Kirby Smart joins us. And we taped Kirby last week, and it's important that you guys understand that as every single day it feels like we have more breaking news in college football and the fluid situation when it comes to testing endemic and how teams are approaching these workouts with players aware of the situation. So when we come up with that interview and you listen to what Kirby has to say, just keep in mind that we taped it last week. The other guest on this podcast is Bruce Feldman from The Athletic, and he joined me on July 7th to share his thoughts on the future of college football this fall, what the administration and presidents throughout the country are thinking, and how they're approaching practices. Because down the road in the next few weeks, if camps were to open, you got to look at certain clusters and how are coaches looking at that, and how are ADs approaching testing and the cost of testing at different schools and what that could mean long term as a Power Five or a Group of Five. Or, when we look at what the Ivy League is going to do and their approach to potentially football, whether it's in the fall or in the spring. Hope you get some information from this podcast. I wish I could say we hope you enjoy it. I can't say that in these times, considering that looking at college football in the fall is becoming more and more of that window getting smaller and smaller on whether we're going to have it because of the concerns of the pandemic. But our fingers are crossed. And it's great to have The Athletic's Bruce Feldman joining us here. And there's a lot to cover here, Bruce. There's so many layers because this is such a fluid situation as we're taping this on July 7th and waiting to hear what the Ivy League's going to decide about whether they're going to have fall football or they're going to push it to the spring. As of right now, Bruce, what are you hearing? Because I've got to tell you, in the last 2 to 3 weeks with voluntary workouts and the testing, and you see the numbers at Clemson, you look around and you're like, oh, wow, this is a little bit alarming at Texas Tech, and they continue. My feeling on us having a fall football season has now gone under 50%, and it's trending downward. What are you hearing?
Yeah, it's definitely from everybody I talk to in the sport, people have gotten a lot more pessimistic in the last really 2 weeks. I'd said last week, the way I looked at it was, well, I'm more optimistic than I was 3 months ago, but not as optimistic as I was a week ago. As the last week has transpired and the more people you talk to in the sport, it's hard to think that this is going to go off just as planned and all these things. I mean, I think you're hearing more about conferences looking at, hey, we may only focus in on trying to play a conference schedule. There's that side of it. Then there's also the part about how can we manage this thing? I mean, I think one thing that you're seeing, and obviously we've seen the numbers beyond just football about cases going up and hospitalizations going up. But I think the things that are harder for people within the sport to kind of see now that they've kind of brought athletes back is they're struggling to keep outbreaks from happening when they're talking about having athletes in small lifting groups and training groups. We're not even talking about them being back as football activities as a group when football happens. You can't, it's not like you can have social distancing on the field. And so that element, I think, has been very hard reality for a lot of people in the sport, coaches and ADs, as they've seen positive tests grow. And also, I think it's hard for them to get their minds around as we're going forward, whether more kids are on campus. It's just, I think right now it's a hard reality for them to get around. And everybody I've talked to said, you know what? I think we're going to know a lot more. We hope we're going to know a lot more by the end of this month, because that's kind of like the timeline for if we're going to have a season on time. But this stuff about the Ivy League, when I started hearing about it last week about them looking very closely at going to a spring season. There was obviously some logistical challenges, but one of the people I talked to coaching that league said, well, you got to remember, we're not a revenue sport here and we don't have a postseason anyway. And so you think, okay, well, that's way different. But then you start talking to people in Power Five football, athletic directors, coaches, and they're like, our presidents think a lot like, and they respect the intel that the Ivy League folks have. And this was something that somebody said to me yesterday, which stayed with me. And it was after our story went up on The Athletic. And it was, if we decide to play, even after, let's say, the Ivy League determined that it's not safe for them to play, you're going to have some uproar for people going, yeah, you're exploiting the players. We don't care about our kids because you're only doing it just because of it's a bit for the financial implications of it. And said, that's a really bad optic for us. And I think that's something a lot of people are wrestling with right now.
And keep in mind, too, with the Ivy League, these presidents all talk. And I go back to March when the Ivy League canceled their tournament, right? What was that? I think that was earlier in that week. I think they were the first Tuesday, right?
I think, yeah.
And when they made that decision, Bruce, I think a lot of us were like, oh, okay, well, wow. And then suddenly you saw Wednesday and Thursday, everybody responded, right? Later in the week, everybody immediately responded afterwards, after the dust had settled from that announcement early in the week. And I think that plays a huge role. And you make a great point that these guys are going to look at the Ivy. I was stunned when the Ivy made the announcement last week that they were looking at this possibility of pushing it into the spring, because we're still in July, but they are forward thinkers. The one thing that kind of gets in the way when you talk about the Power Five is also the talent. You're going to lose a ton of talent. And again, this is all with the safety, with the understanding of the safety of all the young men that are playing. I'm just saying, if you go into the spring, you're going to lose a ton of that talent because, well, you have, you know, I'm not talking about first round picks. Guys that are potentially second day picks, will they want to play? Will they want to play in that spring schedule with a potential draft there still set up late in the spring, right? Then you start to lose the talent.
Yeah, and look, and there's talking to athletic directors, they said there's also, you're bleeding into a second season. And I said, well, you already have spring football. It's obviously not the same dynamic, but then you probably wouldn't have your typical spring practice. But would it be a truncated season in the spring where if it started in January and maybe ran into end of March, because there's going to be certainly the Trevor Lawrences and Justin Fields of the world who see themselves as lock top 10, top 15 picks. The ones who are guys who could end up as first round picks. I mean, you look at the draft this past year, I can think of two LSU guys right off the top of my head. One was Patrick Queen, who was a linebacker in the first round. The other one was Clyde Edwards-Helaire. Those were players who went in the first round who nobody, except for maybe the people who coached them, thought would have any chance of being first round picks or even probably second or third round picks. So there are going to be some players who are going to, you know, it depends what's in, you know, who's in their head and what they're thinking about. About whether they're going to say, hey, you know, I'm going to take my chances on the draft, even if I'm going to be a sixth round pick or whatnot. But I mean, yeah, there's a lot of complicated things that go in thinking about if it's a spring season, as cold it as it is, and you know, you're familiar with it being a Philly guy, as cold as it is in a lot of places in the Midwest and the Northeast in late November, it's even colder 2 months later, right? Mm-hmm. So, and yes, there's more weather issues. So that's a lot of stuff that would need to be sorted out. But, you know, as we talked to some people about this for that story that, you know, ran on The Athletic, it's a real, there's not a lot of attractive scenarios right now that play out this way, as the realities of, hey, if guys test positive, even if they're asymptomatic, they're going to be shut down for 14 days. I mean, you could have position rooms shut down for four, you know, depending on spread. So there's just not a lot of great scenarios to sort through.
And January and February in the Northeast is absolutely brutal. And you can make the same case in the Midwest in certain parts, right? I just think of how cold Chicago can be in January and February. It's in comparison to what it's like in November. Now, you make a great point with the LSU guys, because I look at the number one pick in Joe Burrow, right? Last September, I don't think anybody's thinking mm-hmm. he's the number one pick in the draft. That the season plays out and it's one for the ages, and then he shoots up on every single chart. And I go back to one thing that really stands out right now that we are seeing in professional leagues, and I think the college level is tackling it as well, is the timing of the testing, right? It's a big issue in Major League Baseball that it takes some time. You have to collect the sample, and then you have to process it. You send it to, for example, the story over the weekend with the Angels and the A's. You have to send it over to Utah to get tested. This is a 48-hour to 72-hour process. And hypothetically, if you're talking about the week of a game and you do the testing in the middle of the week and you don't get the results till Friday, and suddenly you have multiple players testing pop. That logistic, have you talked to coaches? Have you talked to administrative people about the timing of the testing?
Yeah, the two biggest issues that come up with that are A, the timing of the testing, and B, the cost of it, right? So you have a lot of schools, and schools that play in FBS football, we're not talking about FCS football, but there's a bunch of Group of Five programs that don't have the resources to test the way they would need to test. And let's say you're playing a non-conference opponent and you test and they don't. Do you not feel comfortable playing against that opponent? Do you not feel comfortable, let's say, they're testing protocols of what you just said? And again, we're talking about Major League Baseball. We're not talking about something like a high school program where you're like, okay, we can tell why they don't have the best resources available. I mean, some of these things are, I don't want to say they're head scratchers, because that makes it look like you're looking down on it. It's just, as you're starting to hear the realities of this, and I think something that's come up a little bit last week, I would talk to coaches and they would say, you know, we thought by late June we would know a lot more, and I'm starting to feel like we know less. And because whatever kinds of thoughts you had on things or things you might have heard haven't proven to be true. So I think one thing that probably is in college football's favor is between Major League Baseball, hockey, and certainly the NBA, you have big organizations who are going back, and they're doing it in different ways, but they're trying to ramp back up. Now, it's a different sport and it's a different prism that they operate, and there is no centralized leadership in college football, but there will be examples like the one you talked about. And I think that's something that, you know, people have got to pay close attention to. And these ADs and presidents, I mean, they're having meetings all the time with their peers about how do we handle this with whatever contingencies and protocols we need to have in place.
Will you see a different when you mentioned it, and having no leadership at the top with college football is a huge, huge underlying story, especially with different rules in each state as well. So everybody's following protocol in their local communities or in their state, you know, state protocols. And so everything is different. What happens in potentially Michigan could be completely different than what's happening in New Jersey. And you're talking about schools in the Big Ten, right? And then you go down the list and you look around, like how California's approaching it compared to Washington, compared to potentially Nevada or Arizona. When these scenarios all play out, I also look at the hierarchy of the Power Five and then everybody else. Do you think this will continue to widen the gap from those 66 teams, let's throw in Notre Dame as well, compared to everybody else, on how this plays out?
I do, because what I think you're also looking at is the harsh realities of the economics of college football and how big of a financial driver that is, right? So if there's an opponent that gets, and let's say it's a MAC school or some other Group of Five program that's scheduled to play a non-conference game against a big Power Five program, they're going to get a bunch of money for that. Well, if either their testing protocols are not up to play, and then their opponent says, look, you're going to have to use some of that money that you're getting as part of this deal to get your testing protocols in place. And they say, well, we can't. We've already spent that money, or we've already budgeted it, or whatever. Maybe that game doesn't happen. Maybe if the Big Ten says, hey, we're not going to play any non-conference games, the financial ramifications of that against for some of these smaller programs who depend on that money, that's only going to make the gap that much harder. And I'll be honest, I don't know. Like, this came up the other night. I talked to a Big 12 AD on Sunday, and he started talking about the what ifs. You can't have a season because it can't be pulled off. He started going down some financial roads that for universities beyond just college athletics and beyond just like who has a bigger budget for analysts and who has a bigger budget for recruiting staff, that are paint a pretty dire picture. And so I think these are really hard questions that a lot of these people are trying to sort through. And like you said, because there's no centralized leadership, because everything seems to be different from state to state, it's only made it more complicated.
Bruce, it's so scary. It is really scary on what this could do to the financial system. But let's also talk about the players. What have you heard from the players and how they are feeling? And with this concept where, okay, we're going to go out there. Do some of them object from, do they not feel comfortable? I mean, we had James Franklin on, Penn State head coach, and he said, I've had 30 plus players that just don't feel comfortable for voluntary workouts right now. And we respect that. So are you hearing from players on when it comes to their comfort level, or are you hearing also maybe players just saying, hey, I just want to play. It doesn't matter. We'll figure it out. I'm young. What are you hearing?
Yeah. I, for the most part, I've heard players who want to play. We did a player anonymous player survey on the Athletic a couple of weeks ago, and I talked to a handful of players, and most of them that I talked to felt more confident in playing. They were stuff they were more concerned about were being around other students and the social distancing and how that was gonna, like when it came to the football stuff and the stuff around the building, I think they were more confident. It was the people around them that I think were a concern, that was more of something that they were a little more leery of. But I've also talked to ADs at big schools last week. One of them specifically said one of the biggest problems we have is 18 to 22 year olds are not taking this seriously enough. And whether that means, are they wearing masks, or does that mean after they leave the facility, they go with their buddies to go play Madden football, or do they go out into a bar with some other people, or to go to a house party? Because that's somewhere a lot of the issues when you're talking about these positive tests surging, at least when it comes to the schools announcing, that's some of the issues. And that's something that I think if you're going to be one person who's going to say, well, you know what, we don't feel comfortable playing, but yet at the same time, you're doing things that, may not seem responsible to it. There's a disconnect there.
You had a story in The Athletic a couple of weeks ago about UCLA football players. They were demanding a third-party health official to be on hand for all football activities. And then there was some clarification that needed to be stated, that whether they trusted Chip Kelly. How did this all play out? Because I feel like while this is public and this was made public, there are probably quiet conversations going around at many campuses with players on saying, all right, do they have our back? Do they understand that we're not comfortable? How did the UCLA stuff play out?
It was weird in that Dorian Thompson Robinson, who was one of the players mentioned in the story from the LA Times, and there was a letter that was obtained by the Times that several players had signed there, a bunch of them. And when I talked to the player rep who was actually on the committee task force to return to play, he said, the weird thing here is these demands that they had in the letter were already going into action. It wasn't like, oh, they didn't. He was like, this stuff that they're asking for, that's already going to be there. So I think what you had, and this is Dorian Thompson Robinson was one of three players. It was, he's the best player on the offense, the best player on the defense, and another defensive lineman all ended up being apologetic. He said to Chip Kelly in the meeting, because he said, we didn't know that that was on the letter that we signed. He said that, like, they signed their names to something. And then he said it became something else. He goes, what we were signing was going to Chip Kelly and the staff. It was never our intention for it to go to the LA Times. And they felt like it was something that came from a player who was no longer in the program, who had to medically retire, and felt like he had a bad taste in his mouth with the program. And there was other stuff in there. But according to Dorian Thompson Robinson, as he told me, he said, this was something we apologize for. This was never the intention of how it got framed, the way it got played out like that.
Yeah, and you can't take back the headline, right? And the perception around. Many of these young men also are learning the power of their voice. Like, if something were, especially right now, in the wake of, you know, the social activism that we are seeing on campuses, as well as from players on social media, realizing that they have a voice and they want to be heard, that there is power behind that. And then again, not to quote Spider-Man, but responsibility comes with that power. Sometimes it can be taken completely out of context in a situation like that. Bruce, I said this before. I don't hold anybody to a number. I think if anybody has a, I'm 100% positive that this is what's going to happen, then they're foolish. But as of the first week of July, what's your gut when you look at the percentage that we will have a football season in September? As of July 7th.
I was going to say, by the time this post, it could drop a percent, you know?
Yes.
It's one of those things where I hesitate to even put a percentage on it, because if I had said I'm 50, you know, like, what is the ask here, that we're going to have a season in September? Or that we're going to have a season
have
in
a
the
season
fall?
In September. No, and whether it's just the season starting in September. And this is not even about a finished season in the fall, just the season that starts in September.
I think there could be some conferences that try to play then. I think it would not surprise me if there was some big conferences that said, you know what, it's just not in our students' best interest for us to do this at this time. And I'll be honest, I really don't know, because this is such a fluid situation. Mm-hmm. And everything that has gone on in the last week. And again, this is talking to people in college athletics. This isn't me sitting there reading blog posts or, you know, sifting through Twitter. It's talking to the people who are dealing with the reality. And when I say the reality, I mean, I'm talking to, like, coaches, many of whom, not all, but many are saying this is going to be much harder than people realize. And I'm just talking about keeping the positive test down, right? Mm-hmm. Because, again, as I said before, they're not even doing football stuff. They're operating in small groups and they're having outbreaks. And also, we don't know that if you test positive in June, that you might not test positive again or have it in October. You know, it's just like, there's just so much stuff we still don't know. And there's so many conversations that are happening in conferences, like, every day. And I just feel like, again, one of the people I talked to said there was a school in his conference that had a big outbreak that they knew about, and they knew how much precaution that university was taking before that. And that was a hard dose of reality that happened in the last week or so. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the things. There's a lot of stuff that also doesn't get reported. I mean, yes, Clemson is telling you what the number of positives are. And Iowa said yesterday that, I guess, four of the five players, they tested, you know, what their results were. But there's a bunch of schools that haven't released what they're saying, what's going on there. And I think that also probably is something to keep in the back of your mind.
Yeah. And, you know, again, the voluntary workout's completely different when they think about practices, because then you got to start thinking about, do you go how many clusters, who's in that cluster? You can't maybe put all the defensive backs in one cluster, because if that whole cluster tests positive, oh my goodness, right? So you may have multiple position players in different cluster groups. You can't have all the quarterbacks in the same space. And then how are you teaching each of them individually? All that stuff has to play in. And again, there is no right answer.
And the thing we haven't touched on here is you have a bunch of us coaches who are in a different age range when it comes to this, right? Mm-hmm. There are plenty of coaches who are 60 and up, and I'm not just talking about head coaches. And there are plenty of coaches who aren't in the greatest physical condition on top of it, right? I know multiple mm-hmm. coaches who already have pre-existing conditions. And so when you talk to head coaches around college football, they think about, how am I going to do? I got a 60-year-old O-line coach who's already had health issues. And if you're an O-line coach, chances are you don't coach at 6 feet distance. You're in the middle of everything. And so those are issues that are front burner issues for those programs. Now, it's not to say that, hey, we're going to shut down football at our school because our O-line coach is 60 or not. But those are real considerations. It's not just like, oh, yeah, there's asymptomatic players who are 19 years old. I mean, it's also, there's other considerations that go with it. It doesn't
Excellent
happen.
Excellent point. And you could look at the NBA as they have been concerned with several of their head coaches. Well, they can't be a part of the team. Or for example, the Lakers with Lionel Hollins, and well, he can't come to Orlando in the bubble. Right. And then you're looking at D'Antoni and Popovich and Alvin Gentry and the idea. We brought this up a few weeks ago before voluntary workouts with Mac Brown and a couple of members on his staff, and if there's any concerns. So that is an excellent point to bring up now as we see more of the young men on campus and then the positive tests coming back on how are you going to coach these kids or these young men when certain things are required and it feels like normally you wouldn't do it 6 feet away, right? And it's just, I come back to one thing, Bruce. Let's all wear a mask, right? Let's all wear a mask, Bruce. So I appreciate you joining
us. If it's a little thing, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And again, it's not going to be the end all, but at least it could cut down on the concerns. Bruce, appreciate it. Wish you the best of health as well. And hopefully we could talk down the fall and we could talk football.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Kevin. Take care.
The head coach of Georgia, Kirby Smart, joining us here in the College Football Podcast. And Kirby, before we even begin to talk about the current challenges of college football, as well as the upcoming season, let's get to the good stuff early. Did I hear that you hoop it up with Pollock and sometimes you've got to carry him on the court?
You didn't hear properly, that's for sure. I have hooped it up a little bit and trying to whip myself into shape a little bit in this quarantine. It's hard to exercise. So I did get to do a little basketball during that time. And the social distancing was not at a premium at that time. And I'll say this, you don't want to be banging bodies with David Pollock. He's still a little too strong for the rest of us.
Hey, Kirby, don't let him fool you now. He's got the personality. Let's say this, Kevin. He's out there the whole time, and he's grinding because he doesn't know how to take it easy. But he's also coaching the whole time, which was my favorite part. Pick him up. Screen. Like it was phenomenal. You can't take the coach out of the coach. It was amazing.
When you're not talented, then you coach hard. So David doesn't have to coach because he's talented.
Well, we won a lot of games.
Does Kirby have a jumper here? What kind of range here? Are you giving him some space here playing defense? How are you guarding Kirby?
Well, if you're gonna talk about that from a player standpoint, coach, Kirby shoots the ball at the top of the key. Coach, I was open. There's a reason you're open. There's a reason because we left you open. He hadn't played in a while, so the jumper wasn't there, but the effort was there. That's all that matters.
I'm going to tell you how good a coach I am. I told my team that any possession that David Pollock doesn't shoot it is a bad possession.
We did come up the floor several times when it was close and it was game point, and Kirby would throw me the ball and be like, all right, you know what to do. Let's go. Take care of this.
End this thing.
Oh, boy. You know what? From here on out, we're going to hear about Pollock's basketball skills, and he's going to be bragging nonstop, Kirby. I regret even asking that question now and opening up the floor on Pollock. But, you know, listen, here's the one thing. We've discussed this many times, Kirby, on this podcast. We live in challenging times and times where we obviously have never experienced before. And for you as a coach, as we look around with voluntary workouts in full swing around the country, you know, major programs have reported positive coronavirus tests for their student athletes. What has been the Georgia protocol if there is a positive test here this past month?
Well, the first and most important thing is we all want everyone in our country and our communities to be as safe as possible. The health and well-being of not only our student athletes, but our the people that are in our inner bubble, let's say, our coaches, our staff, our everything. I mean, there's so many people that are involved in our program outside of just the players that we have to keep safe. And that's an important part. And this recent spike in numbers, I do think that our staff has done a tremendous job. You know, Ron Corson, who was here when David played here when I played. So, I mean, he's getting up there in age. He's the head of the medical staff that represents the SEC, and every team in the SEC has a representative, infectious disease doctors, trainers, everybody involved in the conference, and he's the head of that. So we're getting, you know, up-to-date information day to day. We do a great job of communicating who all's been involved. We've got guys over weekends that may have gone somewhere or been exposed, and contact tracing has worked really well as far as protecting guys. So we got a set of protocol that we follow, and Ron does a tremendous job communicating that. And that for us has worked really well. And we've had good lines of communication, and it's worked really well for us.
Well, and talk about coach just during this time and now coaching and getting kids ready for, you know, a season with everything that's going on. Like, how much has this challenged your patience? And then also, how much has it challenged you to be more innovative or to think outside the box or to do things differently than you've done?
Yeah, it's going to be very unique. I mean, it's already been unique, like you're saying. The first and most outside the box is no spring practice. Okay, so you've got no spring practice. Your players are you know, they're kind of out of your control because they're at home. We can encourage them to do things and activities. Since they've returned, you know, we're not allowed to go down, whether it be a volunteer. We're not allowed to really be part of the workouts or check on things. But the kids have had a great response. You know, we still have Zoom meetings with them. We've Zoom met and talked about social issues and just communicated. It's just so great to have them back here so that we can be. I mean, it's hard on coaches. That's what we do. Our relationships are what make our job so important to us. And when these kids aren't here and they're back at home, it's tough on us from a communication standpoint. So having those guys back around, being able to share time on Zoom still and interact with them, and I know they've enjoyed being part of all this. It's being back, I'm saying. I think that's the biggest thing, is that the guys have enjoyed that. But it's going to be different, David, for us. I mean, when you look at a schedule for fall camp, it's probably going to be different. There's still a lot of questions, you know, as far as how we're going to be able to practice, where we're going to be able to put the players, what is a contact tracing look like from a practice standpoint? Because right now, you know, it's, you know, who have you been with within 6 feet for 15 minutes? That can be, you know, subjective at times. So how's that going to work out when we get on the practice field? And it is forcing us to be innovative. It's forcing us to think outside the box with who guys room with. How do you practice? Do you practice ones and threes and twos and fours so you keep some depth? And it's going to be a unique situation starting out.
You mentioned unique situation here, and we're taping this at the end of the month, the start of July as well, for whoever's listening. What concerns do you have right now? Because I'm not going to ask you about what concerns do you have 2 months from now, because it's such a fluid situation. But as of right now, what concerns do you have that we will have a season?
Well, I think it's just speculative, as you could imagine, to speculate and say, okay, this is what – a lot of things got to go into place. I think the number one thing we have to do is continue to educate ourselves and grow. I mean, just think in just the amount of time that we've had, which has really not been long, 3 to 4 months, these things have changed. We've been told one thing, told another, and then, you know, this has been said, that's been said. Tests are still being developed. We know the inaccuracies involved in the testing protocol. So there's a lot of things that have to happen before the season comes about, but they're also making progress really fast. We're finding out more and more. So as we gather information, I think we'll find more of that stuff out. I mean, my immediate concern is just the safety and well-being of our players. And we give our players a voice. We talk to them. We listen to their concerns. We've tried to do some things where they actually clean the weight room themselves, because we think that that makes them understand the importance of it. Now, it doesn't mean we don't have it professionally clean. We still have it professionally clean on top of them. But I think making them aware that I've got to clean this, when they go home, they think the same thing. When they step out of our building, their understanding of when they got to have masks on and when they don't, that's very unusual, because a lot of our players think that, you know, they're beyond harm. And that's not the case as we're seeing with this pandemic.
That's a great idea. I mean, that's a phenomenal idea, because it is, I mean, they aren't the demographic, and they're hearing this too. They aren't the demographic that's targeted the most and that's affected the most. And me and Kevin have also talked about this. When I was 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old, you told me I had to stay inside to help older people. I'd have been like, yeah, okay, no thanks.
Right.
Cause I'm worried about me, you know, like I'm worried about what I want to do. And I don't really think about the future, but when things will change with the NBA coming back and baseball coming back and all that stuff. When you think about this upcoming football season, I remember when Jamie Newman, I remember watching him last year. Me and Kevin were doing a podcast, and we bring up a baller of the week every week, and it was called, I think, what did you call it? David's Dude, Kevin?
And we
would pick a guy, and Jamie Newman was my guy, because I was watching this cat, and I was like, oh my God. I mean, he's got something special, because he's big, he's physical, he makes downfield throws look easy. He runs the zone read, basically follow, and just does all kinds of cool things and competed at a high level. And I just loved his competitive spirit. You know, now he's at Georgia. Like, what does that look like for you now, having him without spring ball and now coming in replacing, you know, a guy that was there for a long time and very successful in Jake Fromm?
Yeah, we're excited. Jamie's been a great addition to our program. You know, we didn't really get to see him through the spring, because we didn't get the spring practice, but we got to see him some in spring workouts. And the first thing that pops out at you is his leadership ability. You know, he came into a situation where, you know, he doesn't know a lot of guys on the team, but that hasn't hindered his ability to lead. In fact, he's graduated from Wake. He's number one, he's physically well put together. He's mentally well put together, and he's got the right mindset, and he's approached this thing the right way. That's not to say that, you know, he's not going to have competitors coming in here. DeJuan's done a great job. Carson Stetson, JT, if he's, you know, going to be able to play this year and be eligible, which we don't know yet, all those things are going to play a factor. But I really like where Jamie's at. You know, we liked what we were able to see last year. He did at Wake. I think he can create a lot of problems for defenses, and excited to see him go play. And I think it's just so hard to answer that question without us seeing spring ball. That's the toughest thing in a year of transition being coordinator transition and quarterback transition. It's going to be very unique. And we're going to have to do a really good job of managing our practice time and our walkthrough time to make sure that we can take advantage of whichever quarterback ends up being the guy, but especially if it's him, that we can use his skill set the right way.
Yeah, you mentioned JT Daniels. He's kind of that wild card when it comes to eligibility. You mentioned the coordinator change with Todd Monken coming in from the Browns to run the offense, along with Matt Luke leading the line. You know, so many new faces on the offensive side here. And let's not forget, too, you guys are bringing in a fantastic wide receiver class, one of the best ones in recent memory. So you have a ton of freshmen here. You have a big target at tight end that you're bringing in as well. And then you look at the defense, and you have so many returning guys back. Does that, for a defensive-minded guy, how does that help you sleep at night? At least you have some stability there with the experience there on the defensive side.
Yeah, I'm excited about the defensive unit. I think the biggest concern is always, you know, the complacency, the have we arrived? And, you know, they've gotten a lot of hype off of returners and what they did last year, which does nothing for you this year. So I'm excited about that defensive group if they approach things the right way. I would have gotten a really good impression on that from spring, because I was part of a lot of defenses at Alabama that, you know, were coming off a really good year, had everybody back, and they went out there spring and laid an egg. And I didn't get to see that. I didn't get to feel that and kind of see the psyche of that group of, are they hungry, you know, or are they complacent? And it's a disease. It just creeps in if you're not careful, and you can't have that. So I'm excited to see those guys, and just as much on the flip side, to find out offensively who's going to step up. We got to see a little taste of it in the bowl game with Zamir getting some stuff, Kenny McIntosh getting some action. Obviously, George has a lot of potential to do good things. And we've got some good young players on that offensive side of the ball that we've got to be able to use their skill set and get them involved.
I think a guy that you say, you know, a guy like George Pickens, like I watched last year when you watched LSU, you thought, I mean, I know Delpit won awards, all these guys won awards, but you watched Stingley Jr. and you're like, all right, well, he's the best player on the field. And I'll never forget being at the SEC championship game and watching Pickens and him go at it in the second half. And Pickens got him a couple times. And I mean, just when you, an impressive bowl game against Baylor, what about a guy like that on the outside having a legit, because you know how much it means when you have a legit guy that dictates the coverages, you know, but how good can George Pickens be from what you saw a year ago and his work ethic and the kind of kid he is?
This kid loves ball. I mean, he's as natural a catcher as I've ever seen. Just great hands. I mean, some of the catches he's made in practice are just off the charts, and I get to see it every day. He loves football. I mean, he loves football to the point where it sometimes it hurts him. I mean, he's just so energetic after a catch, and he just wants to be excited, and he wants to celebrate with his other players, and that's just George. He's young, and he's maturing. He's physically developed more. That's probably the biggest difference in him, meaning adding 5 to 7 pounds, a little faster. He's not a high school freshman anymore. A college freshman anymore. He's stronger. And so I've been really impressed with the changes in his body. And, you know, again, we didn't get to see him go out there in the spring, but this guy showed us what he could do last year. And we're going to have to do a really good job putting him in different spots so people can't figure him out. And we better get some help. You know, you got to have a little help for him, because there's things you can do to dictate coverage for one guy. But if you can get that second guy and with the backs we got, it makes me feel much better.
Hey, Coach, I always can look at rosters from all the main universities and the guys that are in playoffs, and I can expect a lot of growth from year one to year two. Do you think this year, without spring ball and with the pandemic and all the missed time, do you think maybe that we shouldn't necessarily assume that those freshmen that got a little bit of time all of a sudden become a lot better the next year?
Well, I think they'll get a lot better off opportunity alone. I mean, I think when you look at the guys last year that were freshmen for us that got a little taste, those are going to be the guys that step up the most. Now, maybe not at the same pace they would have if they had a spring game with 70 or 80,000 people in the stands and they get to grow and they get to get some of those butterflies out of the way. There's still going to be a growth and maturation process. But, you know, those 4 or 5 freshmen on defense, those guys are going to be – you know, the biggest leap you make is from year one to year two. And I'm expecting those guys, the N'Kobe Dean, the Trevon Walker, the Tyreek Stevenson, Lewis Singh. I mean, there's some talented young freshmen on that defense that I think are going to step up and be really good players for us.
Yep.
And then offense too.
So, you have this time. And I don't want to say it's time off because you're still working, but you do have this time. And when you look back through the years, 36 wins in 3 years, SEC title, Rose Bowl win, Sugar Bowl win, heartbreaker in the national championship, dominance against your rivals. Is there a moment when you can reflect in the last 3 seasons and you say, boy, that stood out. That's my favorite moment. Do you draw anything from that?
No, because we haven't got where we want to go. We know that. I think everybody understands that in this building, part of this organization. We try not to let the outside noise affect us. We know our goals. We know our aspirations. We know the capabilities we have, and we try to maintain focus on that. So I'm not looking backwards at the things we've done, just like I'm not trying to look way out forwards either. I'm trying to look day by day at this thing as we go through. I certainly have enjoyed it. I've been very proud of a lot of the work we've done, and probably more proud of our kids that come in here and have been now. I've had a group of a class, a complete class, to watch the Charlie Warners move on after being here 4 and 5 years. That's what gives me the most gratification.
I tell you what, Kevin, the most gratification you probably got the last couple of years, though, was last year in 8U football when Boogie, his son Boogie, took a reverse when they needed against AYO Lions. Don't laugh, Kevin. This ain't funny.
I'm not laughing. I love this story.
Yes, Boogie took a reverse. Boogie's an animal. His son is an animal. He could have played on the 6U team a year ago, played on the 8U team, took a reverse and broke every tackle on the field, like 10 tackles, took it to the house. That was the crowning moment. That was the highlight moment. It was for the Titans, baby, for the North Oconee Titans.
Best part about that game is I was leaving. It was over. I'd watched their offense go backwards the entire day, and I was like, I'm getting out of here. And one of the coaches waved, said, wait, we're going to give it to Boogie one more play. So I stopped and waited, and I was like, okay, I got to get back to the office. I think it was on a Sunday, and I was trying to get back in to watch the next opponent, and they handed him a reverse. And it looked like the team was like fake tackling him. It's like the movies when they dive and they like intentionally miss. I was like, every guy dove and left their feet. It was the worst tackling expedition I'd ever seen. And he scored a touchdown. Of course, that was the highlight of his seasons.
It was awesome.
I love the defensive coach breaking down the tackling in that scenario. Now, help me understand Boogie. Like where did that name come from?
I don't know. If you saw him or met him, you'd understand. He's a Boogie. He just always moving, always on the run, and that name just kind of stuck. But he's a mess. I promise you that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the talent that his dad has, because I mean, if I looked you up right now, I found out this article, College Football News, ranking the top 20 college football head coaches based on their collegiate playing careers, and you were ranked number 15. I mean, people don't understand. He had 13 career picks at Georgia. First team All-SEC, led the team with 6 picks in 97, 5 in 1998. Do you think 15 is too high or too low here? I mean, I feel like you should be breaking the top 10.
Way too high. Way too high. When you Seymour Stroud and some of the great players I got to play with, Phillip Benton, I mean, it was easy to play safety back there because nobody got through the line of scrimmage. So I got to sit back and cherry pick things. If I'd had Pollock, I might have been really good then because I'd had a real pass rusher out there.
Hey, Coach, when you look at your background and how it parlays, I think you're one of the best recruiters in the country year after year. And I think it has a lot to do with spending time in locker rooms. Like, you understood the culture of everybody and all the kids, and that's why you do so good. How much did that help you being a player, like, and understand everybody and understand football and understand what goes into it? How much does that help you in recruiting?
Oh, it's ton. Recruiting is being able to have relationships and relate to kids. And I've always thought the background I have in a high school coach's son, having grown up in a locker room, been around players, a lot of diverse background from where I'm from in South Georgia, that's always helped. It also helps being from the state of Georgia, which we know is a really fertile area. And then, you know, having the commitment in the organization to show people what they want to see. You know, we put a lot of work into recruiting. That's from our president all the way down to everybody on our staff. I mean, we tell people all the time, we talk about Chick-fil-A service, you better be Chick-fil-A in recruiting. You better get people through the line. You better do it fast. You better make sure they get their questions answered. And we leave every no stone unturned in our recruiting part. But that's the number one thing you have to do, because if you start out the day, you know, with lesser players than the people you're playing against, then you're not going to come out looking ahead a lot of times. You got to go out and beat. And it's tough now. I mean, in the world of the SEC, that's the biggest. I guarantee you, if you polled every SEC coach, so what's the toughest thing about your job? There is no doubt it's the amount of time that you have to commit to recruiting.
Well, it speaks for you and your relationships with players as well as families. And it's relevant right now, as we have seen players using their voice, like Kylan Hill in Mississippi State and what he had to do for change there in the state of Mississippi. In the aftermath of the George Floyd murder and the protests that followed, you were part of a recording featuring Georgia coaches to student athletes, where you said specifically, we will not be silent. We are committed to healing together. How have you been able to do that in the last month and making that connection and giving your players the comfort and the ability to say, yeah, I can talk, I can speak out and understand that I have power in my voice?
Yeah. Number one thing is listen. I tell you, it's been incredible experience, education process. There's so many things that I've learned that I didn't really pay attention to before, or maybe didn't know the great detail of. And when you actually dig deeper and look and listen and learn, you educate yourself and you can become, I'm not going to say an expert, but you definitely become more educated on the process, and you can have open dialogue and feel more comfortable about the dialogue. I don't ever like having conversations if I don't understand the topic, but as you understand the topic better, and that's what we try to do with our players. We've had every Wednesday, we've had a different dialogue, a different speaker, different somebody come in. I got two coaches on my staff, Dale McGee and Cortez Hankton, have done a tremendous job of providing me with the ability to lead and giving me information on how to do things better. And the number one thing each one has talked about is, you know, two-thirds listening, one-third moderating. And we've listened to our players. We've expressed we want to take action and not just talk. And we've taken some action items and really attacked them. And I've been very pleased with our team, how open they've been. And they've also been very appreciative of our coaches' ability to listen and just communicate and have this dialogue.
Excellent message there. We wish you the best of luck when it comes to health and safety with the program. And let's hope we're talking about football September 7th when you guys open up the season against Virginia. We do appreciate the time here, Kirby.
Absolutely, man. Thank you guys for the coverage, and hope y'all guys stay safe as well.
Big thanks to Kirby Smart, Georgia head coach, for his thoughts on how he's dealing with things, as well as his little breakdown of Pollock's basketball skills. And I'm sure, again, Pollock's going to brag about that for as long as we do the podcast. Also, a thank you to The Athletic's Bruce Feldman, our good friend back in the day at ESPN. And it's great that he could join us to share his thoughts on what's going on in the state of college football and the information that he's gathering in the middle of summer as we approach, hopefully, training camps next month. Big thank you to Taylor Schwenk, our producer on the other side. And once again, we will do our best to bring you information with our reporters throughout the country, as well as coaches sharing their experiences here in the podcast leading up to a season, whether it's in the fall or whether it's in the spring. Thank you. Stay safe and honestly, stay healthy.